when Andy first approached me to talk about population and resources in 20 minutes, I said, no thank you, but could I talk about urbanisation and health? But then I reflected a bit more and thought that as a demographer I did have an obligation to deliver the slightly dismal news. So that is what I'm going to talk about. And I wanted to start with Malthus, the dismal prophet. And because Malthus is actually a much more complex thinker than has often been appreciated in the field of population studies, and maybe you all know this, but you'll certainly know his original argument, which he made in his first essay on the principle of population in 1798. And he made this argument in response to William Godwin, who'd just published an essay on the perfectibility of mankind. And Malthus said, actually, it's really grim. So he said that populations, human populations, are capable of very rapid increase. And he used the colonial populations in North America as an example, where, given abundant resources, they married extremely young and had very large families. And he said that in countries, long-settled countries, however, people were limited fundamentally by land, because land was the basic source of everything that people needed: food, clothing, fuel. And so if you wanted to increase, for instance, the amount of fuel that you used for producing non-food things, then you would need to devote some land to growing wood as opposed to food. So there were these trade-offs. And therefore, if for whatever reason, say an improvement in agriculture, food output increased, for a while people would have a slightly higher standard of living, but then they would increase their population to bring themselves basically back to close to the level of subsistence. And if they tried to increase their food production by expanding into new areas, because the best areas of agricultural land would have been exploited first, there would be a law of diminishing returns. So people would move into poorer land and have lower yields. And so to explain how population was kept in balance with resources, because clearly that's what was happening in long-settled lands, he argued that population, human populations, were kept in check by positive checks, not good checks, but active checks on the population, acting through mortality. And although we often think about Malthus meaning famine, and he also talks about war as controlling human population, he actually thought that most of the time these checks were operating through mortality and mainly acting upon the poor, through particularly high child mortality amongst the poor. And he argued basically that poverty was inescapable for the majority of people, because if ever more food were produced or more means of subsistence, then the population would just effortlessly rise to consume those and reduce per capita food again. Malthus wrote his first essay in 1798, and he's best known for that because he provides this very lucid argument with very few examples. But he then went on to revise the essay in 5 subsequent editions, and he substantially modified his conclusions. So by the time he wrote the second essay, 6 years later, after his first essay, it was a much, much longer essay, much harder to follow his logic, and full of empirical data, because actually he thought that arguments shouldn't be judged simply on their logic, but actually on the evidence that they were based on as well. And 2 things made him substantially modify his argument. One was the evidence from the first English census of 1801 that the population was much larger than people had thought. There was a debate in England before the census about whether the population was growing or shrinking, and it became evident in 1801 that the population was much larger than anyone had thought, and it was indeed much larger, we now know, than it had been for the last 150 years, where it had plateaued at about 6 million people, which looks like a kind of Malthusian ceiling for the English population in the long run. From about 1750, so about the point where Malthus was born, was the point where his argument in his original essay lost its force. At that point, the population of England continued to grow. So by the second census in 1811, the population had grown again, and Malthus realized that, that populations could grow, but he never actually abandoned his thesis entirely. But he did come to see that there was a possibility of other checks operating on populations apart from mortality. And he arrived at this conclusion partly through extensive research of his own, using all sorts of ethnographic and other data from travellers' tales, from accounts from voyages of exploration and colonization in the Pacific and throughout the New World. And he came to argue that, particularly for European populations, they were not held in check primarily by mortality, but actually by what he called a preventive check. And this was moral restraint. And this is very clear now that this kind of system was in operation in the English population. So the average age for women to marry in the 17th and 18th centuries in England was about 26, and not all women married. So in some cohorts, a quarter of women never married. So this had a very profound effect on fertility rates in the population as a whole. and Malthus approved of this, because he thought you shouldn't marry if you didn't have the means to support your children. But in other populations, he recognized there were other controls operating, including abortion, infanticide, and what he called unnatural behaviors, so sex that didn't result in conception. And he labeled these vice and disapproved of them. But it turned out that these kind of preventive checks that Malthus envisaged operating have been the primary checks rather than mortality. So this is showing the for England and Wales. The black line is showing the total fertility rate, and that is, to define it now, and I'll use it throughout the talk, it's the number of, did I not put it on, sorry, number of children per woman in the population, number of children born per woman in the population. And the black line shows that from about 1750, the total fertility rate in England rose quite substantially. And the red line is showing life expectancy, and it's plotted on an inverted axis so that you can see the two moving together. So life expectancy going down is good in this situation. So the gap between these two lines is proportional to the population growth. So actually, most of the population growth of the English population was due to rises in fertility rather than falls in mortality. And the contribution of fertility and mortality to population growth has differed for different populations. So actually, fertility has often risen in populations in the 20th century as well before it's declined, and that's actually quite a widespread pattern. So we tend to think of population growth through the demographic transition being stimulated mainly by falls in mortality and then fertility falling with a delay, but in fact often fertility has also contributed, and this is partly because in the English case, for instance, the fact that real wages could hold up as the population grew kind of meant that what people did with their real wages was what they wanted to do, which was get married, not necessarily have children, but get married rather than enjoy a higher standard of living. In other cases, it's been fertility has risen in conjunction with falls in mortality, partly because maternal health has improved, and in some societies because improving child survival has actually meant that people have been able to have shorter birth intervals with the confidence that their children will survive. So traditional practices that tended to improve child survival have been abandoned, so very long breastfeeding, for instance. So the good news is, on two fronts, that Malthus was wrong. One, populations can go on increasing very rapidly, and the means of subsistence has kept up. And this is because, sorry, contramark, it's not because of the annihilation of the South American populations and the use of their resources to support European populations, but certainly in the English case, England remained largely self-sufficient in food until the 1870s when it was just cheaper to import more. So actually, there was huge improvements in agricultural productivity, but also a switch to coal. and therefore that liberates the land from having to provide fuel to a large extent. So the means to subsist have kept up with these very rapid population increases without a positive mortality check intervening. And also, populations have actually eventually regulated themselves, so fertility has fallen. So what we've seen in the second half of the 20th century is pretty ubiquitous declines in mortality, and they've occurred in fertility, sorry. I usually work on mortality. And these have occurred in a really wide variety of contexts. They've occurred in authoritarian and democratic regimes, and also either with the encouragement or with the opposition of government or religious institutions. They've also, over time, occurred at lower levels of GDP per capita. So European countries underwent fertility declines at relatively high levels for the time of GDP per capita. By the mid-20th century, Latin American countries and East Asian countries entered fertility decline at lower levels of GDP per capita, and more recently, Africa in the 1990s at even lower levels. And these transitions, with the exception of Africa at the moment, have occurred with increasing speed. So it took Britain over 100 years to actually go from population growth to basically stationary in terms of natural growth. Other populations have achieved this much more rapidly, and I'll show you in the case of China. And these fertility declines have been achieved with a very wide array of different contraceptive techniques and behavioural changes, much as Malthus actually noted. So the good news is that there's been fairly ubiquitous fertility decline, good news in terms of population growth, and half the population of the world lives in states or countries with fertility that is now at below replacement level. This figure from the UN, the central bar, refers to approximately now, and of course it only shows 46% of populations at below replacement level fertility, but that's because India's bundled in there as a single country. If you split it out by state, actually, only parts of India have high fertility, so the average is about 2.6 children per woman. But a number of states are actually have fertility rates below replacement. So fertility decline's happening everywhere, it's ubiquitous, and what's the problem then? And that's why I guess demographers avoid talking about it very much, because in a sense, things are happening. So I just want to take you through some of the problems. So this is showing China's fertility rate, so the number of children born per woman between 1960 and the present. And so Malthus considered China his example par excellence of a place where mortality was the check on population. But in fact, historical demographers now think that actually fertility in China was about the same level as in Europe, but achieved by different means, achieved by control within marriage. But fertility appears to have risen, and here you're only seeing a rise after the Great Leap Forward famine, so that's to some extent a spurious rise. But levels of fertility historically were probably about 5 to 5.5 children per woman. So there was a rise, probably associated with improving health. And then in 1971, in response to the realization that the Chinese population was growing faster than expected, and also international discussions of population problems, what's called the later, longer, fewer, Wan Xi Xiao policy was introduced, which aimed for a fertility of about 2 children per woman. By later marriage, longer intervals between births, and fewer children overall. But it wasn't a coercive policy, but it was associated with extensive provision of birth control and reproductive health measures. The one-child policy was introduced in 1979, and of course that was coercive. It varied between provinces. But as you can see, in fact, the greatest drop actually occurred in the 1970s, not under the one-child policy. And there's a number of lines of evidence that suggest that actually the one-child policy wasn't what drove Chinese fertility down, because it probably would have fallen anyway. And some further evidence for that has emerged in the last couple of years, because the one-child policy was changed to a two-child policy in January 2016, and there was a little blip in the birth rate, and now the birth rate has fallen again, and the actual number of children born in 2018 was the lowest it's been since 1961, the last year of the Great Leap Forward famine. So extraordinary falls in fertility. And I just want to demonstrate, though, why China's still gone on growing. And you all know about population momentum. But what happens is, so here we have a pyramidal population, so a rapidly growing population, each generation getting bigger. You get a pinching in caused by reduced births during the Great Leap Forward. And then in the 1960s, these very large birth cohorts born when children, women are having on average 6 children per woman. And then those large birth cohorts are then subject, so now I'm showing you the people, the grey line is showing you women of roughly reproductive age. There were changes in ages at reproduction in this period as well. So these big 1960s cohorts then have small cohorts relative to their own, because they're only having on average 1.5 children per woman, but they were huge cohorts. There's lots of women in them, so even if they have very few children, you still get a lot of children born. But what's happening now is that those large cohorts are feeding into the post-reproductive years, and oops, this is China at the last census, and you can see that what the cohorts coming through now are very small. So the women who, there are far fewer women in the future going to have children in China, and given the low birth rate in the last couple of years and the lack of response to the two-child policy, it now looks, China's predicted to stop growing in 2027, which is amazing, given the contribution of China to overall growth. I'm running out of time, but the bad news is that the optimistic projections about African fertility declines haven't come to pass. So I was doing a PhD in plant biology in the late 1990s, and I was thrilled by all the UN population prospects reports predicting that the world population could even stop growing by 2050. It could peak at 9 billion. And then fall, because I thought I was working on increasing crop productivity at that time, labouring under all sorts of Malthusian fears. And I thought, well, that's a window that we can probably make, and that's achievable. But in fact, these estimates or projections of declines in fertility were based on very optimistic assumptions about falls in African fertility, on the assumption that African fertility would fall at even lower GDP per capita than it happened in the rest of the world, and would fall faster. And in fact, to some extent that's happened. So this is showing a fairly schematic diagram showing, on the left, showing the GDP per capita between 1970 and 2010 in sub-Saharan African countries and in a group of other countries that underwent fertility decline, and the circles show the dates of fertility decline. And you can see that sub-Saharan African countries have generally entered fertility decline in the 1990s at lower GDP per capita levels than the rest of the world. So that gave great cause for optimism that fertility was falling. But those falls haven't happened very fast, and there's been stalling of fertility declines in a number of populations. The figure on the right shows the births per woman, so fertility in red, the sub-Saharan African countries, compared to blue, other developing countries, and against GDP per capita, and it's showing basically that for a given level of GDP per capita, fertility in African societies is on average one child higher. So fertility is higher, which obviously pushes the growth rate up. So it is falling, but since the 1990s, the UN population estimates have been revised upwards in terms of population growth. And they're still quite perhaps optimistic. And so I think it's partly the sense people had that the problem was on the brink of going away in terms of if you view population growth as a problem, and then progressively being told actually it's worse than we thought. So I think it's partly that discrepancy because I think there was over-optimism. And just to finish with respect to carbon, this shows on the bottom total fertility, so children born per woman, and on the right carbon emissions per capita. And you can see that at very high total fertility rates, carbon emissions are very low, but there are no countries with sub-replacement level fertility, so below about 2 children per woman, with such low carbon emissions. I took out all the small countries that ruin the relationship because they have funny carbon emissions, except Costa Rica's in there, it's the one right down at the bottom. So you can actually have very low fertility and low carbon dioxide emissions. But obviously there is a trade-off, because one of the incentives for African leaders to adopt family planning programs is the hope that by reducing fertility they will reap what's called the demographic dividend, the payoff that is argued to occur when fertility falls, and then the dependency ratios, old and young versus working age populations, are small. And so while you could interpret this as meaning you don't get low fertility until you have high GDP per capita, there's a synergistic relationship that as fertility falls, you also may enjoy more rapid economic development. And that's a trade-off that I personally think is worth it. So what we need to I think, address is the carbon dioxide emissions in order to achieve that population growth sustainably. Okay, thank you.